This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Michael Pollan says you don't have to live in a farm state to care about the farm bill that comes up for renewal this year in Congress. In fact, he says, if you eat food, you should be looking closely at what the farm bills have done. In Michael Pollan's view, they've contributed to a modern food production system that will be pricey and unhealthy to maintain. That's the driving line of inquiry in Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. It was also the topic of a recent speech he gave, which we'll hear today on Word for Word. A writer for the New York Times Magazine, Pollan sees weak links in the food chain, from the excessive use of pesticides to the big fuel bills needed to bring food from long distances to the centralization of food production, which he notes didn't work in the USSR. While globalization and agribusiness have given us food that is plentiful and relatively cheap at the checkout, Michael Pollan asks what the ultimate price will be. And one note, if you think eating organic puts you above the fray, Michael Pollan says some question the worth of organic food that comes from so far away that it is burning a good deal of fossil fuel to get to your table. Here then, journalist Michael Pollan speaking this spring at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum.
I want to start with a word, a not very attractive word, a much abused word, and that word is sustainability. We all pay lip service to it, but sometimes it's worth taking a moment to figure out, remind ourselves what a word really means. Confucius has this wonderful line that before we can move forward, before we can reform things and get back to the issues that should concern us, we must undergo a process he called the rectification of the names. Digging back, sort of the way Thoreau did, underneath a word to figure out what does it really mean. What does it mean to say something is unsustainable, too? In my understanding, unsustainability is a practice or system that cannot go on as it has indefinitely because it's destroying the resources or conditions upon which it depends. It's a very simple idea. It is, in essence, a zero-sum arrangement such that every time it produces something, as it moves forward in history, there is a process of subtraction. For it to win or profit, something must be diminished. And of course, we all know that can't go on indefinitely. And that was a very important question for me to get at in this book. It begins with a food chain. Where we fit. Every culture has a place in a food chain. The only difference between us and other creatures is we get to design our food chain, redesign our food chain, and we have done that. But we're still defined in our relationship with nature, by and large, by what we eat. It really situates us. And so I looked at several different food chains. I realized that there were three, possibly four now, that we were part of, to varying degrees. And the first, and the one I spent probably the most time as a reporter trying to understand, is the industrial food chain. The one that begins in a cornfield in Iowa or Illinois and passes through the hands of companies like Cargill and ADM on its way to companies like General Mills and into our supermarkets and fast food chains. And, you know, I had every food chain that I looked at in the book and tried to follow. I think of the book as kind of a series of food detective stories, and me as something of a food detective. And I worked very hard to follow these food chains. And, of course, the industrial food chain is the hardest one to follow because it's the most intricate, the most obscure, and the one also sheathed in the most corporate protection and secrecy. Although I could visit farms and I could visit feedlots with some difficulty, I could never visit, actually, a Cargill corn processing plant. You would not think that would be so controversial to see how corn is turned into high fructose corn syrup, but companies like Cargill, who are privately held and, of course, don't have to talk to journalists if they don't want to, don't have to talk to anybody, wouldn't let me in. So there are places where the detective story kind of falters for a moment. But the big surprise in looking at the industrial food chain for me was that when I tried to follow all this fast food, supermarket food, back to the source, because one of my, again, coming at this as a gardener, as a nature writer, I understood that all food, whatever we eat, begins in a farm field begins with photosynthesis. Because everything we eat, of course, we can't, the only kind of creatures on Earth that can actually take sunlight and water and simple minerals in the soil and carbon dioxide from the air, capture all that, put it together, and turn it into food, into carbohydrates, are plants. So whatever food chain, so all eaters are basically eating plants or eating creatures that eat plants. And so whatever food chain you're going to follow, you're going to end up in a field somewhere, or it might be in the water, because the same process goes on with algae. And so I wanted to know, well, where would all that industrial food take me? And as you know, if you've read the book or read anything about it, I found that all that supermarket food, all that fast food at McDonald's, if you follow it all the way, you end up in a farm field, in a field specifically of corn and soybeans. And that corn is really the keystone species of the industrial food chain. And a remarkable percentage of the carbon that you get in a McDonald's meal, and in fact I quantify it in the book, is corn, even though there's no corn on the menu, because all that corn gets broken down to its molecular components and reassembled either through the gut of feedlot cattle or the company that's making the high fructose corn syrup that's going into the soda or making the oil that's going into the French fries are being fried in. And that this plant, this incredibly clever plant, with the help of some very skillful breeders and some very powerful technology, has over the past 100 years gradually colonized our landscape, our food supply, our bodies, to the extent where now we are the people of corn. A phrase that Mexicans have always used to describe themselves because they have a well-deserved reverence for this one species. And we're up to this year, we grew, I think, something like 15 billion bushels last year, and normally we plant about 80 million acres of corn. This year we're going to plant 100 million acres of corn. So just over the last year, corn's takeover has been advanced, and we all know what's done that. Ethanol. Having eaten all the corn we possibly can and have fattened ourselves on corn to the full extent we're able, we're now going to feed it to our cars. And we can talk more about ethanol later, but to me it represents the final triumph of corn over common sense, over human common sense. Now, there are a lot of problems with the food chain based on one or two crops. And in fact, today, if you add corn, soybeans, and throw in some wheat and rice, these four crops now represent 80% of our calories. We are as diverse as the food supply seems, in fact, as diverse as we think our diets are, because there are 45,000 items in our supermarkets. In fact, it rests on a very narrow biological foundation of these crops, and corn being first in that list in terms of calories. What's wrong with such a food system? Well, there's plenty wrong with it from both an environmental and a health point of view. But what I would submit is that in the sense of this word that I've given you, unsustainable, that a nation basing its food supply on this one clever plant is unsustainable. In terms of energy, it's unsustainable. You know, the whole idea of agriculture is it's a solar-powered system, that we should get more at the end of the year, not less, because we're bringing in this wonderful, boundless source of free energy and atmospheric carbon and water. And indeed, it used to be that we got 2 calories of food energy for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy we used in our agriculture. But the triumph of corn, in a way, has been a triumph of petroleum over sun. So that as we have moved our food system off of the sun to a considerable extent and onto the fossil fuel economy, and that happens in a few ways, but first off with nitrogen fertilizers, which are made from fossil fuel, from natural gas, but also with the diesel in our, you know, for our farm equipment and the petroleum that is the basis of our herbicides and pesticides, with the result that today it takes, and with processing food and driving it all over the country, that we're using 10 calories of fossil fuel energy for every 1 calorie of food energy That is not a system that can go on indefinitely, not if we are indeed approaching the point of peak oil. 17% of all the fossil fuel energy consumed in this country goes to feeding ourselves industrially, as much as we put in our cars, as much as we use for personal transportation. So the food issue is a critical component of the climate change issue, and that is not well recognized. And 40% of that energy that goes into agriculture goes into moving the food around. We have, as you know, a rapidly expanding world trade in food. The food economy is increasingly global. And we are exporting a great amount of food and importing a great amount of food. There are some enormous absurdities in this process. The FDA just approved a scheme whereby chicken raised in America will be shipped after it's been slaughtered to China to be cut into pieces and then sent back here. This makes economic sense. Does it make ecological sense? Absolutely not. Wild salmon, a very sustainable product, being caught in Alaska, is being shipped to China to be filleted and then coming here. So that sustainable wild salmon you're buying in the market, if it comes here, or when it does for those few weeks, may well have passed through China on the way here. Herman Daly, the economist, has a wonderful quote. He points out that we're buying sugar cookies from Denmark, and we're exporting sugar cookies to Denmark. And wouldn't it be a little more sensible to just swap recipes? So I think it's clear to anyone who sees what's happening with the price of fuel that this sort of energy-intensive food system, which again is from beginning in the field and going all the way to the final products, this can't last. Another sense in which this system is unsustainable is pollution. To grow monocultures, any of you involved with agriculture understand, you need prodigious amounts of pesticides because pests love monocultures. All that nitrogen doesn't stay on the farm. Some of it is taken up by the plants, but in general, farmers put about twice as much nitrogen on their fields as the plants can absorb, and this nitrogen doesn't stay put, and it runs into the drainage ditches, into the creeks, into the rivers, into the Mississippi River, and into the Gulf of Mexico, with the result that today there is a dead zone in the Gulf that is the size of New Jersey and growing. This is an area, a hypoxic zone, where nothing will grow. We're turning the Gulf into corn's toilet bowl so that we can grow this 100 million acre crop. That can't last. The tolerance downstate, the Mississippi states are beginning to look north and say, you're responsible for this. This can't go on. And it won't, I don't think. Health. This is a system that's unsustainable from a health point of view. Our food system has some incredible features to it. One is food is remarkably cheap in this country. Cargill, General Mills, all those companies have done an astonishing job of driving down the cost of food. But we've learned recently, and we would not have predicted this, that making food cheap and accessible does not necessarily lead to a healthy population. Indeed, if you make food too cheap, you can get just the opposite. And what a food system needs to do is not just provide enough calories, but really, if we think about it holistically, we want a food system to keep a population healthy. We 4 out of the 10 leading killers now are diet-related chronic diseases. We're learning that a monoculture diet, a diet of processed corn and soybeans, does not keep us healthy. And where I live, in the East Bay of the Bay Area in California, there are children showing up in health clinics today, inner-city kids in Oakland, who come in overweight, overfed, but actually malnourished because they're not getting micronutrients that you simply can't get from soda, French fries, and hamburgers. They're showing up with things like rickets, diseases, nutritional diseases we thought we'd eliminated 100 years ago. And that's because they're drinking more soda than milk. But another point, and another way in which the system is unsustainable, is from a financial point of view. You know, cheap food, as it turns out, is incredibly expensive. And I don't mean just in terms of the environment. I mean in terms of the public purse. We're spending $25 billion a year to subsidize this food system in the form of agricultural payments that are designed in such a way right now to encourage overproduction of corn and soy and wheat and rice and cotton. 40% of the income in the Farm Belt is coming from this USDA check these days. So that's another, financially it's unsustainable. And then from a food security point of view, this system is unsustainable. To concentrate our food system in so few hands, in so few places, leads to a situation where when you do have an outbreak of foodborne illness, which we've had quite a bit of in the last few years, it will be huge and very hard to control. And we had a real wake-up call with the E. coli contamination last fall, where we learned that, in effect, the nation's salad is being washed in one sink in the Salinas Valley. And when that happens and something gets into the water in that sink, it's going to affect a lot of people all over the country. So that the mere concentration of the food system leads to a kind of precariousness that is itself unsustainable. And the last sense in which I want to talk about unsustainability is transparency. After spending all this time digging down into the food system and visiting the feedlots and the slaughterhouses and the fields, one of the senses in which I realize the system is unsustainable is that if more people saw how it worked, they wouldn't want to eat from this food chain. If you could look over the increasingly high walls of our industrial animal agriculture and to see the brutality of that system, both to the animals and the people who work there, you would lose your appetite for the meat coming off those farms. And any system, when we learned this in the Eastern Bloc, in the Soviet Union, any system that depends for its survival on people not really knowing what's going on, is very precarious, because the truth will get out. And sooner or later, the eye of the public, through its journalists very often, and other ways, through activists, will see over those walls. And that's happening today, and you have a movement for a more humane agriculture. And that's because the secrecy of the system is unsustainable. And the more people see, the more light we shed on the system, the sooner it will change. And I think transparency is a very important goal, and it's something that's really lacking in our food system.
We're listening to a recent speech by Michael Pollan, New York Times Magazine writer and author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
So, given all this, you all know these things, and more people are learning these things every day. There is a tremendous appetite for information about our food system. I mean, I know it from editors I talk to. I know it from the success of my book and many other books in the last year. There is, going along with this, some wonderful, very hopeful developments. People are hungry for alternatives. And we see plenty of evidence of this. We see the growth of the organic food market to something like $15 billion. This is a market that didn't exist 30 years ago. This is a market that was created without any help from the government, any institutional support, but essentially enlightened consumers working with enlightened farmers built this tremendous industry, the fastest growing corner of the food marketplace. That says to me, hunger for alternatives. And I'm going to raise some issues about organic and its limitations, but I find that on balance very hopeful. The fastest growing supermarket chain in this country is Whole Foods, offering several alternatives, organic being one of them, local being another, though they also sell plenty of conventional food as well. But its growth suggests to me a hunger for alternatives. And of course, the farmers market. Much harder to chart its growth, but there have been, in the last 10 years, the number of farmers markets in this country has doubled twice to just under 5,000 today. That may well be the fastest growing part of the food economy today, but we just don't know exactly how much money is trading hands there because not everybody is reporting it. It is, in some ways, an underground food economy. But we should pay attention to underground food economies, because that was a real harbinger of change, as you recall, in the Soviet Union. And I think that's happening here today, and I'll talk more about that. So I spent time in the book looking at the organic food chain, and I had some surprises there as well, and not all of them were happy. As organic has grown, as it's gotten bigger, certain compromises have been made. And there are we are moving toward, there are many, many wonderful organic farms, and but many of the problems of the industrial food economy have kind of seeped into the organic food economy at certain levels. And I spent a lot of time in the book following a meal that I got from Whole Foods, the Chilean asparagus that had been shipped, you know, from Chile to my plate and sold for $6 a pound. I was putting four pounds of carbon into the atmosphere to deliver it. That organic, in many ways, is moving toward a globalized, high-energy sort of food system. And at least from the energy measure, we have to question, is organic food more sustainable? Just by that measure, it is certainly more sustainable at many levels. But once it leaves the farm, is it more sustainable if you're shipping it around the world? And right now, in fact, organic supermarket food has more food miles on it than conventional food. And that if you go into your Whole Foods and you go into your Trader Joe's, especially in Trader Joe's, you will find a great deal of organic food coming from China. And that the same kind of crazy commodity chains that have become important in industrial food are becoming important in organic food. And there was an article in a business magazine talking about the Stonyfield Farm yogurt and broke it down and said in some of its products you would find organic milk powder from New Zealand, because there's such a shortage of organic milk right now, strawberries from China, apple puree from China, blueberries from Canada. So this is a world product. And even though each of those entities in it may have been grown without synthetic pesticides, may have been grown, and in the case of China, frankly, we can't be sure, so that's why I use the word may have been grown without synthetic fertilizers. There are a lot of miles on that stuff, and we have to question whether, to the extent our concern with the food economy is about climate change and energy, whether organic is doing the job, and whether we don't need to raise the bar further on organic. So having realized that there were some issues of sustainability even in the improved food chain of organic, I decided as a writer that I wanted to go further and see if I could find actually sustainable farms in the full sense of farms that were not part of this zero-sum system of taking more resources out than they put in. And this led me to a farm I want to describe, because I've been speaking in abstract terms, and I want to talk concretely, briefly, about a farm that I profiled in the middle of my book. And that was Joel Salatin's farm, Polyface Farm in Virginia. I hold it up not because it's the best farm in the country, not because there aren't lots of other people doing equally sustainable things, but because it throws into high relief this whole issue of sustainability, I think. And it shows us what's possible when we think ecologically about our farming, especially our animal agriculture. I went there, how I got there is kind of a funny story. I was writing an article called The Organic Industrial Complex for the New York Times a few years ago and wanted to find some farmers who would give me some salty quotes about what was happening to organic as it was getting big. And everybody pointed me toward Joel Salatin as having some of the saltiest quotes on the subject. And Joel describes himself as a Christian conservative, environmentalist, libertarian, lunatic farmer. And he is all those things. He grows six different animal crops in a very intricate rotation. He grows grass-fed beef, chickens, both layers and broilers, rabbits, pork, turkeys, and sometimes he has sheep, and a couple of food crops mixed in there. On 100 acres of land in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, an area that's really a little too dry for row crops, not well suited, but very well suited to growing grass. So I called him, and we had a long talk about what he calls the organic empire, which he will have nothing to do with, and that Whole Foods, I guess, for him is the is ground zero of the organic empire. And he's not organic. And he, for several reasons, one is he's such a libertarian, he doesn't want the government to have anything to do with his farm. And he believes the best form of organic certification would be unannounced visits to a farm to look at the farmer's bookshelf. And based on what the farmer is reading, now this could be abused, you can see easily how this could be abused, but based on what the farmer is reading, you could tell whether his or her head was in the right place. Because as he says, what you're feeding your mind becomes what you feed your soil, your plants, and your animals. The other reason he's not sustainable, though, is he really feels that it's much more important to support his local economy. So he is willing to buy corn that has been grown with pesticides to feed his pigs. And he just judges that that value, in those competing values, to find organic corn that has come from hundreds of miles away, and as he says, soaked in diesel fuel, doesn't strike him as organic. So I got on to talk about all this, and at the end of the conversation, I said, I hear you grow wonderful grass-fed beef and pastured chickens, and I'm wondering if maybe you could send me some. And I was in New York at the time, or Connecticut. And he said, I can't do that. And I said, well, so perhaps you're not set up for shipping, but I could have the FedEx guy come with the dry ice and the, I really wanted to try, and I was on a New York Times expense account, and I was like, I had their FedEx number, and... He says, I'm sorry, you don't get it. You really don't get it. I don't believe it's organic, sustainable, if you will, to FedEx meat across the country. It was one of my more embarrassing moments as a journalist to have asked this paragon of local to ship me one of his steaks. And he said, if you want to taste one of my chickens or steaks, you're going to have to come down here to Swope and do it yourself. Swope is where he lives, the town. And I ended up doing that. I ended up paying a couple trips. And for the book, I spent a week on the farm. I had what my wife, Judith, who's here today, calls my Paris Hilton adventure. And I worked as a farmhand, and I chose a particularly difficult week to do that. It was the third week of June, and as all of you, any of you who have one foot in agriculture know, that the farm day is sun up to sundown, and that the longest farm days are just around June 21st, and that's when I was there. And what I saw was quite extraordinary. His 100 acres of open grassland yields, just to give you an idea of the productivity here, 40,000 pounds of beef, 30,000 pounds of pork, 10,000 broilers, 1,200 turkeys, 1,000 rabbits, and 35,000 dozen eggs every year. 100 acres of open land. There's also 400 acres of woodland. And that's important to the ecology of the system. But just to give you a sense, when people tell you, can organic or alternative agriculture feed the world, it can be incredibly productive when it's done cleverly. Joel grazes his cattle in very small paddocks and moves them every single day. It's like a quarter-acre paddock outlined in this cheap electric portable fencing. The cattle spend the day in such a paddock. They're, 60, 70 cows on the quarter acre, and they mow it down entirely. They eat everything in sight. At the end of the day... we would go up there and to where the cattle were, and we'd set up a new paddock, another quarter acre adjacent to this one, and move the cattle from one to the other. Now, moving the cattle sounds like a big cowboy job involving lots of pickups and dogs and cans of Skol and screaming and, lassos and the whole bit. But if you do it every day, cattle kind of get the drill. And so... Joel would kind of just open the gate and as I say in the book, with much more the attitude of a maitre d' than a cowboy, and the cattle would all stream from one paddock into the other, very eager to get to the fresh, as he calls it, ice cream, waiting on the other side. And of course, grass at the end of the day has the maximum levels of sugars, and there's nothing cows like more than to get to a fresh paddock of grass like this big. Now, what happens to the paddock they just evacuated? Well, what happens is he waits 3 days exactly, and then he tows in this contraption that he calls his eggmobile. The eggmobile is a very simple structure made by him, very ramshackle looking, and it looks kind of like a prairie schooner. And he tows it in with a tractor into the middle of that paddock, and open. This happens in the morning, and opens these doors that open onto gangplanks. And 350 langhans come streaming down out of this eggmobile and fan out across the pasture. And the interesting thing is they make a beeline for the cow patties. And they go right to work kind of pulling the cow patties apart and picking out the grubs. And what they're eating and their favorite food and their key source of protein are the larvae, the maggots of flies. And the reason he's waited the 3 days is to grow those maggots as large and juicy and proteinaceous as he can. He's actually growing chicken feed by leaving it in the cow pies for those 3 days. But he doesn't wait any longer. If he waited 4 or 5 days, the larva would hatch, and there'd be flies all over the farm. And one of the most striking things about his farm in June was how few flies there were on a cattle ranch. The chickens are, as he calls it, his sanitation crew. And they are essentially his control for flies and other parasites. So the chickens do several things. They eat the larva out of the cow pies. They spread it as they're digging out, so they don't. The cow pies are spread around the field. And in the 3 or 4 days they spend in that field, are fertilizing it with their manure. And Joel knows exactly how many days, how much nitrogen is put down by 350 chickens, and how much the grass can absorb. And that's different every time of the year, depending on how the grass is growing. So he knows, okay, this is this many units of nitrogen, and then he moves the chickens to another paddock. Now, I said at the beginning that he was a grass farmer, and to really understand the beauty of the system, you've got to look at a grass plant itself. What's going on from the grass's point of view in this whole transaction? Well, what's going on when the cattle graze that grass plant, this plant that was this big, goes down to this big, and what the grass plant does in response is very interesting. And those of you who know about gardening and have taken courses here, I'm sure, are familiar with the root-shoot ratio. I learned this in GAR 101 at the New York Botanical Garden, and that is that plants like to maintain a rough balance between their leaf mass and their root mass. And so when their leaf mass shrinks from grazing, they will shed a corresponding amount of root mass. And what happens to all those roots that they've kind of shed or cauterized? Well, they die, and they're set upon by that whole wondrous digestive process that is soil. The bacteria, the nematodes, the fungus, the earthworms all go to work eating those roots and turning those roots into soil, humus. This is how soil is created, from the bottom up. This is how the prairies were created, in this relationship between grass and bison. And you build soil this way. So I realized then what was really wondrous about this farm, besides the wonderfully tasting food that came off it and the great quantity of food that came off it, that at the end of the year, not only did you have the 40,000 pounds of beef and 35,000 pounds of pork, you also had more soil than you did at the beginning. You had more fertility, more biodiversity than you had at the beginning. So you see what the real intellectual importance or theoretical importance of such a system is. And this can be achieved, by the way, simply with intensive grazing, but it works a lot better if you add the chickens, because what happens is that you get much more grass over the course of the year because of that fertilizer and that attention from the chickens. The grass just is up in another few weeks, and you can do it again or cut it. But what you've broken down, what you've disproved, is this idea that's in all our heads about our relationship to nature, that it is fundamentally, inescapably, tragically a zero-sum relationship, that for us to get what we want from nature, whether it's food, energy, entertainment, whatever it is, nature must be diminished. Less for nature, more for us. We just kind of carry this around, unexamined assumption. We have every reason to believe it because we have plenty of evidence that's how it works. But what this example shows you is that it doesn't have to be that way. We are not locked into that tragic relationship. That there are other ways to organize our relationship to nature, our agriculture, that actually can leave the land in better shape than we found it. And to me, that was the biggest surprise and the most hopeful lesson of this book.
Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, speaking this spring at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Now, I want to talk briefly in conclusion about local food economies, because I think that they're vitally important in solving a great many of our problems. We're told it's sentimental, almost reactionary, to favor local over large-scale industrial food economies. That the future is a globalized food economy, where everything will be produced, where it can be done most cheaply, and sold most dearly. Stephen Blank, an economist at my university in California, Davis, says that Americans have to outgrow agriculture. It's not the highest use of our land. Americans farming is like PhDs doing child's play. It's an outrageous statement. And Blank is blunt. And what's useful about him, I think, and I recommend his book to you, it's called The End of Agriculture in the American Portfolio, because there, in its starkest terms, you will find the vision of all who would globalize agriculture, even though they will not be as honest as he is and admit that that's where we're going and that's where the policies we have are taking us, to a place where whatever country can grow it most cheaply will, and in fact, over time, Americans may not grow their food or grow very little of it. Those of us who resist this idea, and there will be more as people realize that this is the program on offer, there are a lot of reasons that you could argue are sentimental, soft-headed, but still worth rehearsing briefly. We like the idea of having farmers around. We like having farmers in our community. Farmers know things about nature. They know things about the water. They know things about the weather. That is very useful cultural information. They enrich our communities. So sentimental, perhaps, but true. We like the idea of keeping land near us in agricultural production of food rather than houses and strip malls, because that is the higher use that the Stephen Blanks of the world are talking about. We like the idea of buying local because we can defend the local landscape. Another aesthetic preference, we like eating food in season, picked at the peak of its taste and nutritional value. We like the fact that the farmer's market sends us back to the kitchen because you won't find any processed food there. You won't find any high fructose corn syrup there. We like what happens socially at the farmer's market. We like the fact that so much more is going on there between the exchange of money for food. It's a place where city meets country, and how often does that happen anymore in modern society, where people politic and schmooze. There's always petitions at my farmer's market. It's a town square at this point. And we like how the farmer's market, or the CSA, community-supported agriculture scheme, lets us reconnect through our food, through these plants and animals and these farmers, to the natural world. That's something else that's going on at the farmer's market. Our kids are learning where their food comes from. Our kids are learning that carrots are not slick orange bullets that come in plastic bags, but are actually roots with leaves on top. This is news to a lot of American children today, and all this is learned at the farmer's market. Now, I'm prepared to defend local food on these entirely sentimental grounds. And I will point out that the key is that there are this whole set of non-zero-sum relationships, all these things going on besides the exchange of money for a product. All these things just grow out of that relationship, and they're extra. They're as gratuitous as sunlight, the social life, the education, the reconnecting with nature. But I would like to move the argument on some harder ground for a moment, because this is the ground that American politics and economics understands. And let me suggest for a moment that it is the globalizers of food that are the real sentimentalists, the Cargills, the General Mills, the McDonald's. That they are, as Wendell Berry has pointed out in a beautiful essay I recommend called The Total Economy, that it is the globalizers who are acting on a faith for which there is no justification. It's not unlike the Soviet communists, the last great destroyers of local food economies in the interests of centralization. They told us, or they told their people too, as we're being told by the globalizers, that we need to sacrifice things we like here and now in the interest, whether that be landscapes or relationships or local businesses, for the promise of future prosperity that will come through the greater efficiencies of a global food system. We must, as Lenin said, break a few eggs to make an omelet. But consider, what could be more unrealistic, more soft-headed, than to propose we destroy things we prize, that we consider precious now, in the present, things that are here for the uncertain promise of some future benefit? And I'll remind you that Soviet Russia founded precisely on the issue of food, on centralizing food. Let us stick with the eggs and keep them from cracking. Let me suggest that there's nothing more hard-headed or realistic than building and defending local food economies. And indeed, to do so is a matter not of sentiment, but of critical importance to national security, public health, and the environment, the health of the environment. And let me just offer, and this is the bookend to the unsustainability list I gave you at the beginning, let me just offer a couple senses in which it is the least sentimental alternative is to defend local food economies. One is, of course, energy. The global food economy depends on cheap energy, not to mention international peace and security from terrorism, to move goods from the point of cheapest production to the point of highest purchase. We will not reduce our dependence on foreign sources of energy or confront the issue of climate change without dealing with the industrial food system. Each of us are putting, as I said, 4 tons of carbon into the atmosphere by our food choices alone. And local food economies offer the potential, it's not automatic, but they offer the potential to shorten the food chains and make them much less, shrink their carbon footprint dramatically. There is also the issue of sovereignty. Do we really want our food system to go the way of our energy system? Do we want to find ourselves dependent on other countries for the vital staples of everyday life? Make no mistake, that is where the globalizers are taking us. National security. The government knows better than we eaters the risks of a centralized food system. In fact, after 9/11, there was a very brief moment of reconsidering this issue. When Tommy Thompson left the Department of Health and Human Services, where he was secretary, he was asked what surprised him, and he said, "For the life of me, I cannot understand why the terrorists have not attacked our food supply, because it is so easy to do." It's a remarkable statement. It was meant as a wake-up call, and it was not heeded. And he had had the GAO, the General Accounting Office, do a study of the vulnerability of the food supply post 9/11, and what they found is, yes, it is very easy to attack. Why? Because it's so highly centralized. Because there's one hamburger plant grinding the hamburgers for 500,000 people a week. So if you manage to contaminate that hamburger plant, you can kill a lot of people in this country. And the GAO pointed to the fact that only 4 companies now are slaughtering and processing 80% of the beef in this country, and down, you know, the whole list. So centralization from a national security point of view is foolish. And if the government were really concerned about protecting us from the threat of either deliberate or accidental contamination of the food supply, they would have a set of policies, and the Farm Bill would enshrine a set of policies that would be encouraging the decentralization of our food supply to make it as redundant as possible. So if something goes wrong with the food in Minnesota, it doesn't affect the people in California or vice versa. But nothing is being done along those lines, and needs to be. Public health. As I mentioned earlier, we've just had a pretty terrifying illustration of the dangers of an over-centralized food supply. From that point of view, this E. coli outbreak in the Salinas Valley. And the lessons of that, I think, are that these are fruits of centralization in 2 senses. That we need to remember that bug that was implicated in that case, E. coli 0157H7, is a product of feedlot agriculture. By and large, grass-fed animals do not carry high levels of this. This is a bug that was never recognized before 1980 or 82 and is thought to evolve in the gut of cattle eating the wrong diet, specifically corn. which acidifies their rumen and leads to the development of that particular pathogen. So you see that narrowing of the food supply down to corn and soybeans, and then taking all the animals off our farms and putting them on feedlots and feeding them, has introduced new hazards into the food supply, E. coli being an important one. But it's also that E. coli outbreak was the fruits of centralization in another sense, which is the fact that one company is washing so much lettuce. And when that happens, anything that goes wrong affects so many more people. And the model of food safety problems, which used to be, you know, the church social, you know, where Aunt Mabel's potato salad killed 5 or 10 people, has been put on this national scope. And not that isn't serious, but it doesn't rise to the level of the kind of national crises that we are having around food safety. My worry, by the way, is that the response to this will be exactly wrong, and an object lesson in how the zero-sum paradigm works, how it perpetuates itself even as it fails. And that is, there is a move underway in the wake of that outbreak to regulate produce farms the way we regulate meat plants, that they will have HACCP programs, that they will have to install inspectors and bathrooms for the inspectors and water testing every day, and that this will ironically, this product of centralized agriculture will lead to the death of local agriculture because of the burden we're putting on local farmers. And we have to be very alert to a regulatory regime that is encouraging centralization. And that we need to figure out ways to decentralize agriculture. And that means figuring out a regulatory regime where small farmers and ranchers and meat packers can thrive. But we're going in the opposite direction. We're putting out of business precisely the small producers who are the solution to the problem. It's worth pointing out that spinach sales never flagged at the farmer's market in the midst of this. Why is that? Well, because people there put their faith not in regulations or technology, but in relationships. People sense all these things I've been talking about, I think. The truth does get out, which is the reason that local food economies are booming right now and are such a fast-growing sector of the food system. And how is this happening? Well, essentially, the most important change coming to the food supply is people voting with their forks. There is a new kind of consumer being born. It's in this room. It's a consumer who does not consume according to the inherited idea of being a consumer, which again is zero sum. I take in, I diminish the world, I consume it. Instead, rather, we have a consumer being born that is a creator, that is spending a little more money for food in order to create new food chains, and that the values of the citizen are being hybridized with the values of the consumer in a very, very healthy way. And that we're understanding that the consumer has obligations, has civic obligations, has ecological obligations, and understands that great Wendell Berry line that eating is an agricultural act, and it's also an ecological and a political act as well. That we can shop for value in the debased McDonald's sense of the value meal, or we can shop according to our values and redefine the consumer as a creator. Now, I want to just say one more word about voting not just with your forks, because that is very, very important. I mean, we've seen it with the growth of organics and farmers markets. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you cast that vote correctly every single time you go to the store. We won't. People will still have Big Mac attacks, even in the utopian world that I'm sketching for you. But even if you get it right a couple times a week, if you spend $10 more a week on food and cast that vote for the grass-fed beef instead of the supermarket beef once in the week, you will build something great and something very large. It really, the multiplying effect is profound. So don't despair if you don't feel you can do this every day at every meal. It's, you know, you get 3 votes a day. It's kind of remarkable. Where else do we get 3 votes a day? Where else do we have so much power to change the world we live in than in our food choices? And as I say, just get one of them right a day and you're in great shape. But as much as we can change by voting with our votes, voting with our forks, we also need to vote with our votes, and especially this year. Every 5 years, the Farm Bill comes around. It's coming around now. We've had a change of leadership in Congress. There are unprecedented opportunities for moving this behemoth. It's not going to be perfect. Compromises will be made, but if it shifts 5 or 10 degrees in the direction of local food systems, organic food systems, sustainable food systems, gets off this footing of maximum production and gives farmers incentives not to produce flat out as much corn and soybean as they can, but to be stewards of their farms, very important changes can come. Now, the Farm Bill, I'm not going to talk about it at great length. There's no sooner way to lose an audience than talking about the Farm Bill. It's boring, it's obscure, it's really complicated. But attention must be paid, because these are the rules of the game. These are the rules by which we all eat. These are the rules that make the corn syrup cheap. And we are subsidizing high fructose corn syrup, make no mistake, at a time where we suffer from an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. That absurdity has to end. That our public health needs and goals need to be aligned with our agricultural policy. Simple as that. That our agricultural policies need to be aligned with our environmental and energy goals. Simple as that. Let the policymakers work out the details. That's where we need to go. But the key is to let your representatives know, and you have some very important representatives in this debate, that simply you're paying attention. Because all they're hearing from is the Farm Bureau, which is to say from Cargill and ADM, and the agribusiness buyers of cheap agricultural commodities. This Farm Bill debate has been decided more or less in secret, behind closed doors, and the reason that it works that way is because no one else is paying much attention. And you have the blue state senators and representatives, or the coastal senators and representatives, essentially trading their votes away because they're not hearing from their constituents that, hey, this is really about eaters. It's not just about farmers. And in fact, don't even let them call it a farm bill. It's a food bill, and it's your fight. Thank you very much.
Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, a book about the sustainability of modern food production systems. He spoke this spring at the University of Minnesota. If you missed part of today's speech by Michael Pollan, or if you would just like to hear it again, our website is wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and go to our archives and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by surgeon and writer Atul Gawande, Einstein biographer Walter Isaacson, and immigration historian David Kennedy. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph and technical director Sam Keenan. And we had help this week from Greta Cunningham.
American Public Media.